Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kabit Ahway. Two historic events in one. On the one hand, the Yemeni Armed Forces' large-scale military operation against the United Arab Emirates, quite a feat considering the precise targeting that occurred. And the second, you have a stab in the back, something the UAE is becoming known for when it comes to Israel, for hosting, this time around, the Israeli president. Both incidents to have happened concurrently. Coincidence? Maybe. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the continued UAE involvement in the war on Yemen, where it appears that it is gambling on risking it all, and the Israeli connection in this affair. Joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Said Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London. He's a journalist and political commentator. We also have international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who joins us from London, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And Said Mohsen Abbas, I will first start with you. You have, once again, another large-scale attack that's executed against the UAE. And I'm coming at the angle of how, after 7 years of war, the Yemeni army is increasing its capabilities, its reach, and its precision, as seen here in an operation called Yemen Storm 3, which it uses ballistic missiles. It just sounds like the Yemeni army is getting warmed up. How do you assess it?
Well, if we look back at the beginning of the struggle in 2015, what's little known is that actually the Yemeni army, much of which had joined the Ansarullah at that time, was already capable of operating various kinds of ballistic missiles. For instance, they had even had possession of ballistic missiles. But let's not forget the U.S. was supplying something like $5.9 billion worth of military hardware to keep Yemen in a nice little civil war, even before the Ansarullah's latest resistance movement. So weapons and arms were awash in Yemen. It was a well-known trading post, if you like, for clandestine weapons. That was a known thing. So first of all, they had the basics, and they had the ability to perhaps reverse engineer certain aspects of weapons production. And what they've done is, as you rightly pointed, they've just got better and better at it. There's no hidden secret that on the international arms market, anybody can, in a conflict situation, can go and get weapons. But the kind of weapons we're talking about here, I mean, we're talking about sophisticated drone technology. We're talking about ballistic missiles, and the latest ones they've used to hit Abu Dhabi, etc., are the Zulfiqar missile. So clearly, they are getting access to ever newer technology, ever more precise, ever more effective, and that's just something which the Saudis and the UAE are now going to have to totally take on board, and it should, I guess, influence the way they go from here.
Sure. Well, Edward Corrigan, it's interesting that you have the Israeli President Isaac Herzog visiting the UAE. In a parenthesis, I should say, is a stab in the back of Palestinians. And then you have, obviously, what has happened, which is this ballistic missile. I don't know if it's a consequence or it was actually planned that way. That part we don't know. But we need to talk about the fact that this so-called normalization of ties, the UAE is on fast forward, fifth gear. Now the Israeli president, I mean, the Israeli media and publications are all over this, saying how there's been such diplomatic flurry between the UAE and Israel. Whatever happened to the Palestinian cause that the UAE at least showed before that it was interested in, is it just on the wayside now?
Well, actually, the Israelis and the UAE have had clandestine contacts over the years. It's now in the open. Obviously, the UAE doesn't care about the Palestinian issue, and they're actually increasing their security and military connections with the Israelis, and it's reported that actually Israeli mercenaries are in UAE operating weapons and to attack Yemen. And of course, the UAE with the Israelis went into Scrota and took it over. So the UAE is establishing or helping establish an Israeli base on Scrota Island, okay. Which is
well,
very,
let me jump
very
in here real quick. Let's bold that out. Let's make that bold. I mean, you just kind of skimmed over it. And if I heard you correctly, which is one of the questions I was going to ask, because Yahya Sari, the Yemeni army spokesperson, talked about how there are Israeli mercenaries involved in this war. Are we talking about Israeli mercenaries who are on the ground in this war?
Well, it sounds like it. That was what my interpretation of it, that they're actually manning weapon systems and providing assistance to the UAE. The West, the Americans, the British, the French have been providing strategic assistance weapons, and it's also the UAE said that they attacked one of the launch sites that the ballistic missile was sent to the UAE, and they showed that something be destroyed, and UAE doesn't have that type of technology, so they would have needed to get the support of either the Americans or the British to be able to do the targeting. But we're seeing a clear escalation, and Israel has a long history of supporting, right-wing repressive regimes, typically dictatorships, and it's continuing in the same light. And the UAE and Saudi Arabia are becoming more and more dependent upon this type of support.
Sure. Let's break this open a little bit. And it's an interesting development has come out of this, say, Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to the Israeli connection. Our guests there obviously said something that is now in the open, pretty much, of the Israeli involvement. Now mercenaries on the ground, technology that's being used, Intel, being at the heart of it, maybe, along with probably hardware. But Israel has not actually offered the UAE what it wants, rejecting UAE's request for the Iron Dome defense system. Now, why would Israel do that? Is it saying to the UAE, you can get bombed, but we'll help you otherwise?
Well, the Israeli defense industry is very selective about how it arms any of its neighbors, even if they're complete puppets. Clearly, they've not armed Saudi Arabia or not given it the ability to produce its own weapons because they have to carry on buying. So part of not giving the Iron Dome or being very selective about the kind of weaponry they give the UAE is because they are quite concerned, quite clearly on the ground, that the UAE and such nations are not that strong, and they're not, that the fragility of their leadership could lead to their overthrow, could lead to the collapse of their entire infrastructure, and then what would happen then? All of that military hardware, as has happened in other places, would end up in the hands of their rivals, their opposition. This, of course, happened in Yemen as well, where much of the military hardware which the Americans had handed over to the Yemeni Hadi government at that time ended up in the hands of Ansarullah, and they obviously used it very willingly against the Saudis themselves. So there is that situation of not being able to give them the kind of sensitive information that might end up in enemy hands. That's the first thing. But you see, internally, what's more concerning to Israel is that the kind of technology which the Houthis and the Ansarullah are now getting their hands on would mean that actually if Ansarullah identify Israel as a player within the actual direct war, then Israel and Tel Aviv potentially become part of the targets, because logically, if Israel is willing to interfere and cause trouble for the Yemeni people and its so, people's army, then clearly they're
so
on,
they know
on
that.
The target list, and their ballistic missiles could reach Tel Aviv.
So they know that, Yemen. I'm sure, Said Mohsen Abbas, I'm sure they're intelligent enough to know that they will become targets because the Yemeni army has threatened them also if they continue or if they cooperate. So why are they continuing with this, you think?
I think it's between a rock and a hard place, really, the Israelis. Their Yinon plan has collapsed because of the work of the Al-Quds and Lieutenant General Soleimani, and the way they've, if you like, checkmated them in virtually every arena they've tried to expand, from Syria to Lebanon through to Iraq. Now, Yemen is very much part of that chessboard. And if the Israelis go leave Yemen alone completely, they have that distinct potential that the Suez Canal and the trade that comes through the Bab al-Mandib and through the Suez would be cut off. That would give Israel a headache in terms of its own economic internal setup. It would also hand over the initiative, they think, to folk like the Islamic Republic of Iran, who are, of course, morally supportive, and some would say militarily supportive.
Sure,
to the
sure. Let's talk about the Iran factor here a bit. Edward Corrigan, when Naftali Bennett came out, the Israeli Prime Minister, after the UAE was hit just a little over a week ago, he came out and said, "We will support our common enemy." Now, the last time I checked, the enemy for Israel in this war would not be Saudi Arabia. It certainly wouldn't be the UAE. And not necessarily Ansarullah. Common enemy, I'm guessing the way they were referring to it, would be Iran. Is Israel trying to get back at Iran somehow by getting itself involved in this war? Does it have a strategy there that it thinks that it could perhaps get at Iran?
Well, the Israelis are always talking about getting at Iran, and have assassinated numerous Iranian scientists, and have in every forum, you know, complained about the Iranians, and, you know, if we listened to Israel, that Iran would have had a nuclear weapons 20 years ago. But, you know, the Israelis are already involved. They've got troops in Unscrota, which is Yemeni territory. So the Israelis are involved, but they're keeping their involvement low-key because of the, I think, the probable backlash in the Arab world and the Islamic world to this direct Israeli involvement. These Israelis like to work under ground and sort of secretly, and they've been doing that, you know, for years in Lebanon. Actually, the Lebanese just arrested a bunch of Israeli spies in Lebanon,
right?
And you have you know, so they're the Israelis see all the Arabs and Muslims as enemies, okay? Unless, you know, there are corrupt dictatorships like the Saudis and the UAE that the Israelis think they can use, and that's out of a position of weakness. The UAE and the Saudis are afraid of their own population, and, you know, they're weak. Their policies are not supported.
If they are afraid, Mohsen Abbas, the UAE, it's a tiny country. I don't think there's more than a million people there, and you have a bunch of companies there and expats, and you have a lot of foreign investment and a lot of visibility in terms of ads, resorts, and so forth and so on. All of that is being gambled by the UAE. Now, either the UAE is not thinking properly, I'm sorry to say it that way, or it is being given some kind of direction to be aggressive. My question, why is it gambling itself in this form and fashion, and at this time where we're seeing more visibility, or should I say aggression, from the UAE?
Well, they've been so deep inside the pocket of Israel and America for so long that actually it's a habit that they can't get out of. And not only that, the fact remains that inside their civil service, inside their deep state, inside the entire infrastructure of the United Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabians, let's not kid ourselves, the The Mossad, the CIA, the Americans not only are covertly involved in manipulating and controlling those folk in these governments, but they're also quite overtly also employed and engaged through private corporate companies that come in to do all sorts of jobs for them. Blackwater is for one, you know, Academy, I think they're called now. But these are just some of the kind of examples of how actually most of these nations' internal operations are run by, you know, effectively people who've been trained by Israeli and American friendly individuals, if not their direct assets who are working undercover. So it's very hard for the UAE and these folk to jump out of that basket straight away. But what they ought to be looking very carefully at as a people, the Arabs generally, who are in the pockets of Zio-American imperialist interests in that area, they need to look at the region. In the long run, West Asia is a region in which neither Iran is going to leave, nor they are going to leave. The Americans will leave sooner or later. They will not be there perennially. So really, ultimately, what the West Asia region has to do is what Iran has been advocating. And even for Saudi Arabia and the UAE, Iran has been handing out olive branches for so long, which they failed to take. And the idea is that, look, in the region, you really need to look after your own interests. Your oil is going to run out. Your gas is going to run out. Whatever else you've been making money through carbon resources over the last 7 or 8 decades is going to go. What are you going to do after that? If you're going to trade with your neighbors, that's your primary source of wealth generation.
Sure.
It makes sense, really, for the UAE to turn tail now, actually drop all their agendas for joining Israel, joining America. Their long-term interests lie
That's the problem, though. Edward Corrigan, what our guest there, Samuel Son Abbas, says, the UAE does not have aspirations that are limited to just the region. We're looking at the UAE being involved in many African countries. You know, we can talk about that and how with Israel they want to pretty much control ports from what it looks like. You know, they're very interested in ports. The port of Aden, you're looking at another port which my memory fails right now to recall, and you look at the ports over in Africa. But I'd like to zoom in on the mercenary aspect of which you talked about, Edward Corrigan, Israeli mercenaries, but in particular how the UAE has, based on a report back in 2018, hired actually so many mercenaries that they said it amounted to a private army. From what I'm reading and from the research done, it amounted to among about 30,000 that came from Latin America. But the thing that stood out here was the fact that many of these were comprised of former U.S. Special Forces operatives, and they were hired to assassinate some politicians within Yemen. The U.S. involvement there is shows that, you know, this war machine is just turning. Tell us more about the purpose that U.S. has here, its function as trainers or as being mercenaries in this war.
Well, the CIA and other security agencies in the United States and the United States Pentagon have been training, you know, soldiers all over the world. There's a camp in the southern states that, you know, is trained officers and has been, you know, linked time and time again to various massacres, coup attempts, overthrowing governments, and, you know, training them in basically, you know, dirty warfare. But when these people retire from their active service, then they go and hire themselves out as mercenaries. And the UAE has got, you know, far more money than they have brains, so they hire a lot of these people. They're hiring people from, you know, children even from Sudan and other places. And but these mercenaries are not defending their own country. They're there for money. They're not going to have the same sort of commitment as we see coming from Yemen, who are defending their country and are putting up, you know, ferocious resistance to the Saudi and UAE attack on the country itself. So there's a whole army of mercenaries out there, and Blackwater, under their new name, is only, you know, a tip of the iceberg. But the UAE's got lots of money, but they don't have support of the people, and they don't have an army that would function in a normal sense.
Right.
And they have to buy it.
Well, I'm trying to figure out the UAE's role, Seymour and Abbas. You have said they're in the pockets of the United States and Israel, but again, looking at some of the facts that are out there, one of them is the U.S. use of the UAE, where when Trump, at least, was in heading the White House, there were UAE-based corporations that employed American, Australian, European mercenaries. And then what happened was they used it, for example, to assist Khalifa Haftar. So is the UAE more entrenched than what meets the eye with the U.S. in terms of U.S. foreign policy objectives?
Well, I think they see themselves delusionally as a mini Sparta. There's no doubt that they are a far better military than any of the other Gulf Arab nations, and perhaps that's what they were being primed for, as being the front outfit that was going to look after Israeli-American interests when they couldn't station their bases so easily around the area. Well, clearly that's not working out exactly as planned, because once the vulnerability of the commercial aspect of the UAE has been exposed, or Saudi Arabia for that matter, it is going to make them really think, because Dubai, Abu Dhabi, all of these nations, their trade, or their commercial trade, their trade as ports or as a seafaring maritime nations, is where their wealth will come from. Now, if you've got a nation which is being targeted by UAVs and by ballistic missiles, there's not going to be a lot of trade going on. People are going to balk at coming over. For instance, the Expo, the current Expo that they were planning, etc., is going to get affected. People are going to not invest. And that's exactly what the Yemeni military has been saying to people now, saying, look, don't go there, because we're now hell-bent on actually giving them as good as we've got. They've come here, they've constantly interfered and uprooted our nation. They brought ISIS and Al-Qaeda into Yemen. They nurtured them in the south, and so therefore kid gloves are off. And if anybody tries to trade with the UAE, they can expect to be reasonably made a target.
Right. Final question goes to you, Edward Corrigan, since we're almost out of time. Are we going to expect more attacks coming from Yemen on UAE if the UAE continues with its participation in this war?
Oh, absolutely. The Yemenis said they've got, you know, a bunch of hundreds of missiles and drones and other vehicles to attack the UAE. And, you know, a lot of this is economic warfare. Since the attacks of the UAE have taken place, there's been a massive decline in the stock market in the UAE. And, you know, so there has been business consequences that affect the country, and you have they are much more vulnerable than what they, and they also, even the Israeli Iron Dome didn't work, and you know they can't defend against multiple attacks. They may be able to stop some, but not all of them, and that makes the UAE vulnerable.
Of course. Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Edward Corrigan there, international human rights lawyer, many thanks for your contribution. And Said Muslim Abbas, a pleasure to have your insight on this, journalist and a political commentator from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahwe and the entire team here in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye until the next Spotlight.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. Allahu Allah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فقد كذبوكم بما تقولون فما تستطيعون صرفا ولا نصرا ومن يظلم
So they will deny you, disbelievers, in what you say, and you cannot avert punishment or find help. And whoever commits injustice among you, we will make him taste a great punishment.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 19th verse of the chapter. فَقَدْ كَذَّبُوكُمْ بِمَا تَقُولُونَ So they shall indeed belie you of what you say. فَمَا تَسْتَطِيعُونَ صَرْفًا وَلَا نَصْرًا So you shall not be able to avert nor get help. وَمَنْ يَظْلِمْ مِنْكُمْ نُذِقْهُ عَذَابًا كَبِيرًا And whoever of you is unjust, we will cause him taste a great torment. The latest couple of verses we were discussing were only talking about the situation of the pagans and polytheists in the next world, how they will argument against the Almighty Allah, and how they will bring excuses in the next world. As you may remember, the previous verses said that on that day, the Almighty Allah will muster them, and also the things and the ones, the entities they worshipped instead of Allah will be brought by the Almighty Allah. And He subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Was it you who misled my servants or did they themselves go astray from my way? This is what the Almighty Allah asks the idols or the other entities except Him that were worshipped in the world. Their answer will be, we only take you as guardian. We wouldn't dare take any other guardians besides you. But the problem is that you did provide them and their fathers to enjoy till they forgot the message and they were a people in perdition. And the 19th verse says that they have nowhere else to run. They will not be able to avert the penalties and they will not get help. One of the sources they might think they are able to get help is from their fathers and their ancestors. I mean, these verses do not only put emphasis on the prosperity of these pagans. They also emphasize on the ancestors' prosperity. Because when a child grows up in affluence and wealth, it seems natural that in this case, he mostly discriminates against others and he will not easily get rid of his comfortable life. But the point is that if you want to stick with Almighty Allah's commands, if you want to stick with your religion's programs, you need to know the religion needs sacrificing.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتألقا تمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The commands of Almighty Allah sometimes need migration. Even you will be sometimes ordered to participate in holy war. Martyrdom is an inseparable part of defending the religion of the Almighty Allah. Sometimes accepting different kinds of deprivations, sometimes refusing to surrender yourself to the enemy. They are all the different problems that you have when you accept, when you want to stick with Almighty Allah's commands. And all of these go with the temperament of the rich people less, unless their personality is superior to their material life. These are the kinds of people that if one day everything is good, they thank Allah. And if it turns against them, they do not get upset. They do not get unsteady. In other words, they dominate their material life. They're not its servants. They're not the slaves of this life. They are not for long the qawman bura, as the Holy Quran said. Since a land which has no tree or flower plant is in fact corrupted and dead, it is called ba'ir, and this is where the word bur comes from. Therefore, the sentence وَكَانُوا قَوْمًا bura, and they were a people in perdition, refers to this matter, that because of this luxurious life and forgetting Allah and resurrection, this group has been corrupted and destructed. And this is what has caused them not to be able to avert their penalties and not to be able to get any help. The 19th verse says, فَمَا تَسْتَطِعُونَ صَرْفًا وَلَا نَصْرًا. Studying nations that are blessed with this world's goods and know nothing of Allah and other nations makes the vast meaning of these verses more clear. Sometimes the lands of the hearts of people get empty of the flowers of the human values and they forget all about spiritual life. May God save us from these situations. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key. Unwind all the secrets, this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always hurt me anyway, and that's when faith begins.
first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
Nous.
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year. But NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We are asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Leading business owners, producers, and entrepreneurs were invited to a special place, Beit Rahbari. That's the official residence of Iran's leader. The meeting was aimed at allowing industrialists to share their concerns and highlight the major challenges they face in the production process, with leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, listening and taking notes.
Your Highness, production is always associated with problems. If we want to produce, we need to brace for any possible problems. I dare say even the world's biggest entrepreneur, Mr. Bill Gates, could not manage a coffee shop under these difficult circumstances. But Iranian producers manage to run their businesses with all the foreign-imposed hardships.
تولید داخل رو
let's not sacrifice domestic production for imports. I proudly say that our biotech products have the capacity to be exported to other countries if the government lends its support.
در حالی که بسیاری از کشورها با شروع
At a time when the coronavirus pandemic led many countries to face shortage in medical supplies, Iran faced yet another problem, US sanctions. But thanks to the efforts of our medical producers, we did not face any shortage in medical items during the pandemic.
We are fighting an economic war. We Iranian producers are the economic soldiers. So it's heartwarming when our leader lends his support for us. But it entails practical steps by authorities to make a change.
We got along with sanctions. We learned how to run our businesses despite the sanctions. The only thing we need to do is to modify our domestic regulations in favor of local producers.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed the efforts of Iranian economic operators in keeping domestic production and the economy afloat amid the toughest sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran. He said thanks to those efforts, the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has hit the wall, and that's what American officials have also admitted. Addressing the government officials present in the meeting, Ayatollah Khamenei put major emphasis on the need to avoid tying the economy to the outcome of the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution believes the ultimate solution to the country's economic problems is to rely on the young minds. As he said, they have proved competent in all areas, from the production of COVID vaccines to precision-guided missiles. It's the second time in almost 2 years that Iran's leader has met with Iranian producers. Ayatollah Khamenei has on different occasions highlighted the need to boost domestic production as the key to resistance economy. To this end, he has taken symbolic and practical measures, including naming the current Persian year the year of production, support, and the elimination of obstacles, calling on authorities to materialize this slogan.
Boosting domestic production has been one of the main concerns and priorities of Iran's leader. Today, he once again urged the Iranian government to not wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions to fix the economy, and instead capitalize on local producers, as he believes this is the only way toward a resilient economy that can withstand foreign pressures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. And Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands, a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Al-Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My words for Palestinians in Al-Naqab is that we will always be supported and we are all united in the face of this aggression.
In their speeches, Palestinian factions stressed that the issue of Al-Naqab is the issue of every Palestinian and they won't sit idle in the face of these illegal crimes.
This event is organized by the national and the Islamic forces in Gaza and all the Palestinian tribesmen in order to express our support to our people in Al-Naqab, who are under the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. Israel wants to expel those people from their lands and homes, and this is unacceptable for us. We are together until breaking the Zionist Bennett, who threatened to build an iron wall around our people in Al-Naqab.
Calling it an ongoing Nakba, hundreds of Palestinian citizens demonstrated in Al-Naqab, while dozens of them were arrested by the Israeli regime. The number of Arab citizens in Al-Naqab is estimated at 300,000, living on 5% of the land, of which they said that Israel had confiscated 95% since 1948.
And Naqab has seen a dramatic escalation as the Israeli regime intensifies its apartheid policies of seizing the Palestinian lands. Palestinians here stress that Al-Naqab is not alone in this struggle. They also say they won't remain silent in this battle against the Israeli crimes. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility. The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis.
Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences.
Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kisra town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There's an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for a negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinians in the Negev. The event was held in the east of Gaza by Palestinian resistance factions. In recent days, the Israeli regime launched violent attacks in the Negev to evict Palestinians from their villages. Palestinians view Israeli attacks in the Negev as a continuation of the 1948 Nakba, when Palestinians were forcibly displaced from their homes during the creation of the Israeli regime.
This criminal entity will never succeed in stealing our land. Destroying the villages will not break the will of our people in the Negev. As we stand here, we say to the enemy that we will defend the Negev. like we defend all Palestinian lands.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians in the Negev suffer from continuous displacement attempts in order to uproot them from their land and homes. Every year, hundreds of Bedouin homes are razed to the ground as part of the Israeli regime's settlement expansion projects in the Negev. Hamas has called for unity among all Palestinians to fight Tel Aviv's expansionist policies.
We stand in solidarity with our brothers in the Negev who are being subjected to ethnic cleansing and apartheid. The Israeli regime is a racist regime and we will not sit idle as it attacks our people in the Negev. By attending this event, we are sending a message of unity to all Palestinians against the crimes of the Israeli regime.
The Islamic Jihad movement accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Palestinians.
Normalization by some Arab regimes has given the Zionist enemy the green light to commit crimes against Palestinians in the Negev. Those who normalize ties with our enemy are giving legitimacy to the Zionist enemy. The Zionist enemy is a criminal and racist regime and will defend the Negev.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in the Negev.
People here vow to stand by Palestinians in the Negev who have been subjected to ethnic cleansing by the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
After the Friday prayers, people gathered to protest against Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on Yemen, demanding Prime Minister Imran Khan to use his influence to stop the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yemenis chants are down with USA, down with Israel, and down with Al Saud. They're the best Muslims who are fighting with Israel and other US allies, sacrificing their children and loved ones. Those killing Yemenis are arranging anti-Islamic concerts in the Holy Land in the name of modernity, and even banned recently an Islamic preaching groups from India and Pakistan.
Yemen is facing an unequal war for more than 7 years now. The war has claimed tens of thousands of lives, many of them women and children.
Recently, we are witness that the Yemeni people are more than Palestinian and Kashmiris are oppressed. So it is our duty as a Pakistani, I feel that it's our obligatory duty to stand with the oppressed people of Yemen and to condemn all of the oppressors, including United States, European governments and their puppets, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other allies.
Rights groups say while countries continue to turn a blind eye, there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all doors demanding accountability and justice. Member states owe it to them to take this forward at pace. The welfare of millions is in their hands. Protesters are outraged at the ongoing Saudi atrocities in Yemen. They are calling on the international community to take immediate actions and end the bloodshed. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out fighting this week. Not the contrite, apologetic Prime Minister a week earlier over Partygate, allegations of rule-breaking parties under his roof during lockdown last year.
Even though these things are quite damaging, none of them constitute an artillery shell into his bunker. So that's why Boris is still alive and peddling his pipe.
Boris Johnson's list of problems have grown bigger in recent weeks as more images and allegations of illegal parties at his residence emerged. The result, an official inquiry and a police investigation. The former by senior civil servant Sue Gray. The outcome of those investigations are yet to be published, but the scandal is taking its toll. Apart from the opposition, some members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party have called for his head. Others say they're waiting on the Sue Gray report.
Well, of course, we all want to know the story, warts and all, but the police are saying that it would prejudice a police investigation. And much as we don't like that, nobody's going to be able to stop them taking the line that they choose to take. What I fully expect is that the Sue Gray report will reveal more of the same sort of antics.
While some MPs in the Prime Minister's Conservative Party sit on the fence, the Court of Public Opinion has already come up with a verdict.
If he's found to be guilty of these things, then I guess he's got to go.
He should quit. Very hypocritical from start to finish.
Just admit it and just say it happens.
He should resign.
That has meant plunging popularity ratings, a 32-point lead for Labour, meaning some Conservative MPs would face a near wipeout if a general election were to be held now. Add to that a cost of living crisis and fresh accusations of corruption over the funding of his Downing Street flat refurbishment.
It's hardly the first time Boris Johnson is having to wriggle through controversies, but the odds are very different this time. If he's found to have misled Parliament about those parties, he will be in breach of the so-called ministerial code. Saeed Puriza, London.
North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized, and leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea. South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th. With North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month, security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Imam Khomeini, the reviver of pure Mohammedan Islam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Today we start a special series on this occasion, and today we are going to somehow get acquainted with Imam Khomeini as the unmatched leader of this great movement, which changed all equations in the world and shattered the dreams of domineering powers. Stay tuned, please. Imam Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini returned to Iran on February 2, 1979 at 9:27 a.m. after 14 years and 3 months being in exile. His return home accelerated the struggles against the tottering Pahlavi regime, and within 10 days, the Islamic Revolution triumphed with the motto of spirituality, Islamic values, and independence from any foreign power. 43 into the Islamic Revolution's